All right. We are in the middle of our Lent series. We have been looking at what it means to follow Jesus in a time when white Christian nationalism is on an upswing of visibility. And this morning, I wanted to talk just a little bit about violence and militancy in this stream, and then look at Jesus for some guidance on how we might relate to that. So just to start us out, over the last few months, I've been reading a number of sociologists who have been studying this over the last 20 years or so, and they've tried to boil down some defining characteristics of these white Christian nationalist movements. And they can vary a bit from scholar to scholar, but there's three features that tend to pop up again and again are generally agreed upon. So the first one is the desire for traditional hierarchies, especially around gender and sexuality. So we talked about that last week. The second one is comfort with authoritarian rule in what is perceived to be a chaotic society, and comfort with violence associated with authoritarian power. And then there's a much smaller subsect, but that is comfortable with violence that's like deemed necessary to establish a theocratic or a Christian-favoring regime. That's about 19% of people. The third thing is strict boundaries around national identity, like who's part of the in-group. This encompasses race, nationality, and so on. And we'll address that in a couple of Sundays when I preach more on Palm Sunday. So our friend, Dr. David Gushee, the ethicist who's a friend to our congregation, he puts it this way. He says, Christian nation ideology is the belief that America is and ought to be a white, straight, native-born, hetero-male-led, militarist, authoritarian nation, and that this is what it means to be a Christian nation. And then we obviously saw some of this militarism on display on January 6th in 2021, and in some of the marches that were leading up to that day. I know there's been, excuse me really quick, caught in my throat there. There's been a little bit of a collective forgetting, I think, about the violence of that insurrection. I know I don't really want to think about it because it's just a little too stressful. So I'll tell you, I'm not going to linger a lot on it, but I did want to just say that I think that I felt a little bit like, as a pastor, it was a bit of my civic duty to read through some of the reports on that. Like, I read Liz Cheney's book, and then I read through the government report on Christian nationalism and that its role in the Capitol insurrection. I don't think you need to read it, but if you want to, I did put a link on, like, the additional resources on the handout this morning, if it's something you're inclined to do. But I thought it was important, at least for pastors or leaders, to be just looking at how our religion is being used so that we can address it and make sure that we are naming that and denouncing it. I think what was clear from that report was that the people who had been taking part in some of these marches were just really primed for violence, using religious imagery and language in ways that were inappropriate. Right, so they named a woman who had been praying at the Supreme Court that morning, and she was praying out loud in a large prayer circle for people. And she was praying, this is our moment, Lord. This is our moment to take our country back. It's our moment to fight. With you as our weapon, you are our fighter. Right? So very battle language. And it's one thing, you know, for you to pray for God to fight for you as a metaphor. I think that's a perfectly fine thing to do when you're praying. Like, God, go to battle for me. I need you to fight this for me. But it's another thing to be in a giant crowd of people where a lot of people were able to get their firearms through checkpoints and then be praying, this is our moment to take our country back, right? So that leap between metaphor and reality is no longer a leap, right? Those two things are kind of overlapping. It can get quite confusing. The marches that were building up to January 6th were called Jericho marches. Right? It was drawing from a Bible story in the book of Joshua where people blew shofars, which are ram's horns. Let's say, like in the story goes that people blew shofars, marched around a city one time a day for 6 days, and I think it was seven times on the final day. The walls fall down, and then the city is destroyed. It is one thing to say or pray something like to borrow that imagery of our shared stories, right, and just be like, God, I need some breakthrough, God. I just need you to, like, knock down some walls. I really need you to, you know, come fight for me. But it is another thing to literally buy ram's horns and take them with you and blow them as you're walking around the Supreme Court, the White House, and the Capitol building with armed people and a gallows set up. Right? And suddenly it becomes very unclear how you're using that story, and it starts to blend into reality. Right, so you've got this imagery of spiritual warfare, of going to battle, of using Bible stories in ways that they're not meant to be used. That is not how I would read the book of Joshua. That's a whole other sermon. But I would say I blame the leaders in this case much more than I blame the average people who have been strongly misled about how to properly read and use scripture. And it was a toxic brew, right? It was a toxic brew that was bubbling up in a part of Christianity that has always had violence entwined in its theologies, right? Theologies that in years past justified killing and displacing the native nations, justified slavery, justified the era of lynchings and Jim Crow, right? So this violent stream of white Christianity has always existed in the United States. And I look at what was happening as just that continuation of that same stream that has always been around, fortified and fueled with poor theology and really bad leadership. The God that Christian nationalists imagine Jesus to be is like a powerful warrior who is prepared to go and vanquish adversaries and return America to its Christian roots by force if necessary. So in their imagination, you know, Jesus was killed by Rome the first time for being nonviolent. Now he's going to come back and be, you know, a warrior for America. We'd love to center ourselves in these stories, us Americans. Kristen Cobes Dumez of Calvin College, she writes this. She says, they want the warrior Christ who wields a bloody sword and defeats his enemies. They want a battle with that Jesus. That Jesus brings peace, but only after he slays his enemies, and that Jesus sanctions the use of righteous violence if a government opposes God. If you deem somebody in power to be working against the goals of a Christian America, then you should not submit to that authority. You should displace that authority because the stakes are so high, the ends justify the means. Right? And then she goes on to note that with few exceptions, white Christian nationalists do not accept this same sort of militant masculinity when it's exhibited by Black, Middle Eastern, and Latino men. Right? She says, aggression by people of color is seen as a threat to the stability of home and nation. We'll address that a little bit more in a couple weeks. But this warrior Jesus of theirs is mostly for white people. But we know that Jesus neither carried a weapon nor advocated battling a government. At the time that Jesus lived, we know that his people were occupied by the Roman Empire. And they experience the Roman Empire as corrupt and ungodly. And it's true that whenever there is a powerful and corrupt government, there's usually a diversity of thought for how to handle it. Right? Some people worked with or placated the Romans. I mean, there's a strategy even today that some minorities use. It's like there's no like government institution or corporation that is like perfect, right, to work for. So the idea is you take the money from the somewhat corrupt things and refunnel whatever resources you receive from working there into organizations that are subversive, right? That's one way that you can sort of manage living under an unjust government. Some people in Jesus's time went off to the desert to create a utopian community. Some people handle it that way. Most people are just trying to live their lives, right? That's the vast majority. And then there's a subset of people who were advocating for violent insurrection, right? And they were called zealots. One of Jesus' disciples was called Simon the Zealot. He was very likely somehow associated with that political movement, at least before he started following Jesus. And then there were others who used what is essentially terrorism. They would apparently randomly knife people that they thought were Roman sympathizers, right? And those people were called Sicarii, which meant dagger men. And some people think it's possible Judas Iscariot was a dagger man. His last name has some sort of resonances with the word Sicarii. And so violent rebellions and sympathizers to sort of terrorist violence were part of Jesus' environment. I personally read Jesus as advocating nonviolence in the midst of all of that. And I want to note that he developed that nonviolent ethos within the context of his own Jewish faith. Right? I want to make sure that we don't enforce the false belief that like the God of the Hebrew Bible was violent and then Jesus came along and preached peace. because that's not the case. Just as in Christianity today, there were and are different streams of thought about how to relate to violence as a person of faith. So Jesus, I see him as in that stream of nonviolent faith in his own tradition. But he was friends, it does seem like, from people who came from different cultural streams sympathetic to it. And so we see him addressing that in places like the Sermon on the Mount, where he was up in the Galilee, which was actually kind of teeming with a lot of people who were sympathetic to the zealots. And so he's on the hillside talking to a large crowd of people. And this is from Matthew 5, 38 to 45. He says, "You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, don't resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you. Don't turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, that you might be children of your Creator in heaven." Right? And if you listen to those things, turning the other cheek, giving away your second coat, walking an extra mile, loving your enemies, those can seem passive. But I don't think that's what Jesus is actually doing here. So if you've been around a while, you've probably seen me do this once before, but I think this is a really important passage. I'm going to have Rachel help me in a second. there's a scholar who really helped me with this passage, because I thought, you don't want to just be like what we're supposed to be, like doormats. The scholar is Walter Wink. And he was arguing that Jesus wasn't advocating for this passive submission to violence, but he was instead offering a really revolutionary way of resisting. So we're going to start with the turning the other cheek bit, and I want to do two little caveats before you come up, Rach, just so you don't have to stand here. The first one is you just got to know that you hit people with your right hand in that day and time. Your left hand was considered unclean. Right? If you even gestured with your left hand in some of the most stringent communities, like the Qumran community, you had to do 10 days penance. Right? So it was like really taboo. It's still taboo to use your left hand in a lot of the Middle East and parts of Asia, other parts of Asia today. It wasn't that strict for as many people, but I think it was pretty well accepted. Your right hand is the hand that you would hit someone with. The other thing that we need to know before we go into this is that there were like social rules about who you could hit and how, right? So if someone was lower than you on the social totem pole, you could backhand them. In fact, you were expected to backhand them, right? So master to slave, unfortunately husband to wife, male to female, Roman to anybody who's not a Roman citizen. And so you could backhand them without any penalty. If somebody was of your equal social standing, if you backhanded them, it would cost you 400 silver pieces, 400 zuz. If you front-handed them or punched them, it would only cost you 4. So like you really weren't supposed to do it, but it was kind of like, you know, whatever. So now I'll have Rachel come up. Is it okay if I step down? I don't advocate you actually do this at home. So if Rachel's using her right hand, and it says very specifically, if somebody hits you on the right cheek, she has to backhand me, right? You want to do it again? Really hard?
No.
Oh. I could get, she didn't want to practice it this morning really either, so. Right, so what Jesus is talking about here is somebody who is probably of a higher social standing, backhanding, like to his people he's talking to, or like if you get backhanded because you're of a lower social status, turn your other cheek, and that forces her to front hand me. Right? So it forces her to like treat me as an equal. It's saying, you've got to honor my dignity and you need to respect me as a person. All right. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you. Did a good job. Thank you. And of course, never hit your anyone. But, right? And so it was in this way that, you know, turning the other cheek becomes a subversive act. Right? It's like, look at my humanity. I'm the same as you. And it's an invitation to the person who's doing that hitting to sort of transform their heart toward you, right? It's a call, you know, for them, it's a call to like, oh, see this person as an equal. To the person who's getting hit and turning their cheek, it's really a call to courage. It's a call to creativity. It's a commitment to justice and love. and it robs the oppressor of the power to humiliate, right? So then with the coat, if someone sues you, or anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. And so this is a reference to the Jewish law in Deuteronomy 24. And so in Jewish law, if Rachel, say, loaned me money, I need money, Rachel loans it to me, she would give me the money, and I would give her my outer coat as collateral for that money. She could hold on to that until I can pay her back. However, the law says that if, like, I'm really poor and I only have two coats, right, that she should then bring that coat back to me at night so that I can wear it so I don't go cold. Does that make sense? And so then I would give it back to her each day. If I then, in turn, fell further and further into debt, and I was just unable to pay Rachel back at all, she might then take me to court to try and get any assets that she could by legal means. You know, my coat, my whatever, if any farming equipment I have. Debt was a major social problem in first century Judea, and it was a direct consequence of Roman policies. So what Jesus is saying here is that a person should try and expose the injustice that's taking place of poor people becoming even more destitute through excessive debt, right? So then if you're in court, if you strip down naked and you hand over both of your coats, in the culture of Jesus' day, looking on the person who was naked brought shame, not to the naked person, but to the person looking on them. Does that make sense? So by stripping naked, the person who is in debt says, look, you've already taken me for everything I have through unjust, maybe legal means. So just go ahead and just take it all. I want to show you what you're actually doing to me, and I want you to feel the shame of it. You have everything except my body. Are you happy? And there's been, I don't have this in my notes, but there have been groups who have used that sort of stripping naked, against the South African regime. There's been different times where that's been used to very great effect as nonviolent resistance. That bit of teaching might have raised some eyebrows. It might have gotten some laughs in Jesus's time, but that's what effective nonviolent resistance does, right? It reveals the absurdity of what's happening in the moment in order to highlight the truth of what's happening. And then going the extra mile. In Jesus's time, Roman soldiers were legally allowed to ask subject peoples, like the Jewish people of Palestine, to carry their packs for 1 mile. But only 1 mile, because Rome didn't want the subject people to be even more upset than they already were and revolt, which they had already been doing some, right? So they're like, we'll just put some limits on it. And there were penalties, pretty severe ones, under military law if a Roman soldier made a person carry a pack further than 1 mile, right? So Jesus here is saying a little bit like, throw them off their game, right? If you insist on taking a Roman soldier's pack an extra mile, it just leaves them wondering, like, why would you do that? Are you going to report me? Am I going to get in trouble? Are you saying that I can't actually carry the 60-pound pack? I think we're invited here to imagine a scenario where a Roman soldier is then kind of pleading with a Jewish person, like, please, give me back my things. Just give me my pack. Why are you still carrying my pack? Right? And it's kind of like, who has the power now? Right? Who's feeling vulnerable? Who's feeling a little confused and off their game? Right? So by telling his followers to go the extra mile, Jesus here is challenging them to use this legal requirement as an opportunity to assert their dignity and their power. And they could demonstrate that they weren't just a slave or a tool for the oppressor, but they were a person with agency and dignity, and they can carry a pack an extra mile if they want. And so I think Jesus believed this whole eye for an eye mentality was just a cycle of violence that perpetuated itself. And so he was calling his followers to try and break that cycle by responding to that violence with creative nonviolence, right? It was meant to be empowering in an era when his people had very little power. I should add, though, there are Christians who find some violence acceptable in cases of self-defense. I would probably include myself among them. I know some of you have served in the military. There are people who see the military as withholding the tide of evil in the world. And I think we do live in an age where we've got weapons that can do such catastrophic damage that I think that there's room for ethical discussions about how to minimize harm. Right? There's something called just war theory. We've gone through it from the pulpit before. I could do that again. That's what that's dealing with. There's a lot of ethicists now who are saying we even need to adjust that just based on the kind of warfare that we're seeing. But I think it's a place where there can be really sincere disagreement between Christians about how to handle that. But the one thing that is very clear is that violence, if it's ever used, it should be limited, and it should be implemented as an absolute last resort when there are no other options. And I think that if we look just at Jesus, we see a man who refused to fight back. He was a man who refused to instigate an insurrection. He was falsely accused of trying to do that, and he was put to death by Rome. But we believe that God vindicated his nonviolent justice-seeking path by overturning that death sentence, right? But that's skipping ahead to Easter. We'll get there when we get there. Violence has been justified by Christians through history, and when they've done it, it's most often because our faith has gotten really tangled up in various nationalisms or tribalisms. And so I think we need to be especially careful when we see that happening. And we think Christians should not be signing their names on gallows in front of a Capitol building so that everybody knows, you know, Emily was there for posterity, and writing things like, hang them high, in God we trust, God bless the USA, hang for treason, amen, which is what is literally written on one part of the gallows. Because the Jesus that we follow looked at Peter when Peter took his sword out to defend Jesus, and he told Peter, put that sword away. Right? And he was teaching, blessed are the peacemakers. And so that needs to be our posture, not go take the Capitol. All right. I'm glad to be done with that one. But, oh, man, it's just stressful watching that stuff. Lord, I'm just going to pray for a minute in lieu of the meditation. Just Holy Spirit, I just ask that you would give us wisdom. I would ask that you would show us how we can interrupt cycles of violence in ways that are creative and nonviolent. I ask that you would help us to be able to bear witness to friends and family who might be maybe not supportive of violence, but just sort of passive to it, that we can bear witness to your Son and how we understand a nonviolent God in this world. I ask, God, that you would bring us comfort. I know that it can just be really collectively stressful, and so I ask that we could really lean in not only to your Spirit of comfort, but to each other, that we know that we're not alone, and we've gotten through hard things together, and so whatever is coming, whatever is sort of simmering under the surface, I ask that we would just feel this collective comfort and love and solidarity. We thank you so much for the witness of your Son, Jesus, who came to show us how to live in a way that was integrous and courageous, and that called us to really be our best selves in terms of loving our neighbors and loving the people around us, including our enemies. And I ask that our hearts would be open in that same way. In your name I pray, amen.